Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today I brought back Azealia Danto to talk about Haiti. She's first going to talk about how serious the issues are and how many people around her have been killed and taken out. And she's going to specifically talk about four people that were killed. And then she also had six assassination attempts on her life, and she's going to talk about a couple of those things. And then she's going to talk about how she had a water program to bring water to people in Haiti and how she believes the Clintons shut that down. And then in episode two, because this is a pretty long interview, we split it up into two episodes. The second episode, we're going to talk more specifically about child trafficking and child sex trade, how the Catholic Church is involved, unfortunately, and how the different players get involved. And she talks more specifically about what's going on there and how politically different groups are involved and how you can help out and who you should reach out to and who you should not reach out to. She also talks about the child pedophilia and the symbols and the NGOs that are related. It's a pretty sad situation, and it's important that people get an idea of it and try to stop supporting these things. If we want our country to change, obviously we need to clean up the swamp. And I think part of that is understanding and realizing it's there and starting to get rid of it. Because if this is the foundation of our country, how can we solve so many of the important things that we need to solve when these are the kinds of things that are going on in our name with our money? So let's get into that interview now with Azealia Danto. Hi, Azealia. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
I'm really glad that you decided to come. I know this takes courage, and really diving into this topic is a very serious discussion. And so I want to start off right at the core of what we're going to be talking about. The Clintons and others have set up a crime haven in Haiti. But before we go into that, can you illustrate the seriousness of these crimes and the courage that it takes to stand up to them? Can you tell us how many people around you have been killed, not from the earthquake or cholera, but like in mysterious circumstances where it's obvious they've been taken out for political purposes?
It's such a difficult question because a lot of, so many people have been killed around me because I've been dealing with two U.S. regime change. But the most significant ones came after the first coup d'etat when I, in 2004, when I was directly involved. So I can say, for instance, that very recently, a member, a founding member of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership was suddenly got a massive heart attack. This was right after the, elections, the two elections, the election in Haiti and the 2016 elections. He died on February 3rd. And we had been working together and talking together this whole year, trying to see how we could make a way out of no way. His name is Yves Pointe-du-Jeu. And I talked to Yves, 5 o'clock that day, or at least I called him at 5 o'clock that day. And, the next thing I know, someone else is calling me from the Haitian Lawyers Leadership to say that he had a massive heart attack. It's very suspicious because as far as I know, there was nothing wrong with him. We were communicating. We did our last interview about how Donald Trump could drain the swamp, and it's on YouTube. And every time I see it, I remember Yves Pointe-du-Jeu. He was a transportation engineer. He had spent his entire life wanting to go back to Haiti and do transportation. The way he was doing it in Maryland, he graduated from Morgan State. And, we just always used to talk about how one day we're going to get rid of these vampires and these imperialists. Haiti's going to be free, and we're going to sit at a beach and drink to all this work. But he is gone. I'm going to give you three more examples that are very, very important. A client that I represented, the best, the most iconic human rights activist, Father Gérard Jean-Just. In 2004, he was the one, when Aristide was taken out in 2004, for extra disrespect to us, it was doing our bicentennial. The United States had the special forces put him on a rendition plane and bring him back to Africa just to tell us what they can do. So they dropped him and his wife in the Central Republic, and there rose up Père Jean-Just, Father Jean-Just. Father Jean-Just had been a human rights icon in Miami for decades. Most of the people in Miami who were at Chrome Detention Center back in the 80s, back in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, he fought for them. He fought for all the get equitable immigration status so that we were treated just like everybody else. But Father Jean-Just was leading the demonstrations to say, Aristide had 5 years. Why would you take him out? And people kept saying 5 more years. But the U.S. brought in the Marines on the bicentennial. They wanted to do exactly what they had done in Kosovo in 1999, which was they used this idea that this is a humanitarian mission, that Aristide had become a dictator. And because he had become a dictator, they had to take him out. Between 2006 and 2004, 2004 and 2006, in the first 2 years of this 13-year occupation that we're in right now, between 14,000 to 20,000 Haitians were massacred by the police and the UN altogether. The UN provided the, and Father Jean-Just was the voice that went out with the demonstrators who peacefully demonstrated for a return to democracy. What they did was they set him up, said that he had somehow been involved in something, and they beat him, and the UN took him and put him in jail. He was put in jail twice. He died, and when he died, I was in his hospital, and he said to me that something happened to him while he was in prison. He kept scratching himself. Something happened, and he believes firmly that he got some sort of poison in there. And eventually when he got out of prison, he was dead. They said he had some blood disease like leukemia. That was Father Jean-Just. And you can find all the information about him. The other one is coming up every August 12th, 2017. Every August 12th, the Haitian Lawyers Leadership that I lead, we remember. His name is Levinsky Pierre-Antoine. Levinsky Pierre-Antoine was disappeared in UN-occupied Haiti. He was, he worked with us. He was part of something that was called the Esli Witness Project. What I did when the coup d'etat happened in 2004 is I used my own funds and I would buy laptops, cell phones, satellites, and so that folks could be on the ground and send me information that I would send out, because what the media was saying about what was going on in Haiti and what was really happening were two different things. So Levinsky Pierre-Antoine was a psychologist. He was a human rights activist. And what he did from the first coup d'etat, he had an organization called Fondation 30 Septembre, which is a foundation for the 30th of September, and which was when they had the first coup d'etat. And what he was doing was providing psychological help for the victims of both coup d'etats, the first one, Bush the first, and the second one, Bush the first. He said to me, and he's also said it to many other people, that during the second coup d'etat, the U.S. embassy tried to get him shot by the military police and the coup d'etat folks that they had hired to become the terrorists, the sort of ISIS folks like Guy Philippe. He said that, and he gave a name, and it's out there. He said that Luis Moreno, the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. embassy, essentially brought him to the U.S. embassy. He said he was terrorized. He was questioned. He was trying to get out of the country because they had taken Aristide out. And everything was in chaos. and he had family in America, and he had a green card. After you, Luis Moreno had whatever you call it, interrogated him, they put his name on a list of people to be killed. I don't know who put the name in, but the name was being, it was a radio station of the coup, they control the media, the mercenary families, the ones with money, and the U.S. embassy, the way they do the, they control, they pay money to journalists with these programs that they call democracy enhancement programs of their, in, you know, and so most of, by that time, all of the Haitian media was kind of owned by the regime change folks. And so they were reading out names of people who were trying to leave the country. And he believes that the U.S. Embassy gave his name to the radio station. And by the time he was able to make it to the Haitian airport, he was Guy Philippe, who was the death squad leader that had been trained in Ecuador by U.S. Special Forces, that had been given money in the Dominican Republic, that had been constantly trying to get rid of Aristide. Those military, those folks were looking for Pierre-Antoine. He says the reason that he was able to get out of Haiti in 2004 was because the Canadians had taken over the airport at the time, and the Canadians would not let the U.S. military in, so he was able to come in. But he went back. He came into exile. That's where I met him. We worked together. He was part of, and then he went back to Haiti in, like, I believe, like 2007. He was disappeared in 2007 when he got to Haiti. And to this day, nobody knows what happened to Levinsky Pierre-Antoine. He was disappeared in UN-occupied Haiti. And when we went to the UN and we went to the U.S. Embassy and we asked them, you know, can you have an investigation? They said they didn't have the time. So he's gone. We have no idea what happened to him. And he's someone I used to talk to, just like Yves Pointdujour. I mean, I can go on and on and on. I'll give you one last one.
So I want to hear your last one. But how many people, I mean, do you have a count?
That I personally knew? I don't have a count of, I mean, no. I'm just saying to you that during the second coup d'etat, I know our count was 14,000 people died.
But how many people that were like you, like educated, trying to make a political difference, were knocked off because they were scared? Because I know there's a Haitian person who's ready to be a witness against the Clintons in Haiti, and that one mysteriously died before he could testify.
Yes, yes. You know, I don't believe that one. I know that they're saying that, but his name is Klaus, and Klaus was practically a protege of the Clintons. And the person who actually wrote that piece doesn't know anything about Haiti, because they were saying that Klaus was about to go testify against the Clinton Foundation. He wasn't about to test. He would never. This guy is you know, we have a class system in Haiti. These light-skinned Haitians, they don't really mess with the people like that are Comacota, that were outside of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's Harlem space, saying, where is the money, Bill? In that article that alleges that Klaus Eberwein was asking for Bill and Hillary Clinton to, you know, where is the money? That's so wrong. This guy would never be with us. I think that's just someone trying to misdirect folks, what they're doing. And this is what Americans have to understand. They're misdirecting you. There's a lot of real body counts of the Clintons. This one is put in there for some reason. I have no idea why, probably to discredit that the other ones are real. That's what they do.
Because if somebody digs in, they're going to say it's all BS.
Yeah.
So you have one more that you want to share with us as an example. What is that about?
Oh, my God. I just went out of my head for a second. I can tell you. Okay, so we did Levinsky. I did Pierre-Jean Juste. You know, I one that I remember, oh, my God. this is really kind of interesting because they use Wyclef Jean with this one. One of the ways they use celebrities is they can go into spaces that maybe like a traditional police force can't go into. So for instance, Jay-Z or Dr. Dre or some of these pop hip hop icons might be able to go into a space in Chicago or in Compton where you have the Crips and the Bloods that maybe policemen couldn't go freely. And they use Wyclef Jean. Anyways, his name is Emmanuel Dread Wilmer. I say his name, Emmanuel Dread Wilmer. Haitians say that he is the hero of the 21st century. When the coup d'etat happened on our bicentennial, Emmanuel Dread Wilmer was a Lavalas supporter. Lavalas is the movement against dictatorship. He kept saying, you know, five more years, we want Aristide back. He was in Cité Soleil. Cité Soleil is like Sun City, that's the name of it. Cité Soleil has about 450,000 people. And it was created by sweatshops. Back in the 80s, when America first started their idea of doing assembly plants, Haiti was the first place that they did it in. But when China opened up its doors and there was no longer any communism, it was cheaper for them to leave Haiti and go to these places. So they left the workers with no job and it became Cité Soleil. That's why when Bill and Hillary Clinton said they were going to do a sweatshop as a development for Haiti for the earthquake, we said we've been through this already and we got Cité Soleil. So what happened to Cité Soleil is that those people who lost their jobs because the jobs left and went to more cheaper spaces, it became a slum. And they became also the biggest supporter of Aristide because he was going to try to get them work and bring up the minimum wage and so forth. Well, they brought in the UN to destroy Cité Soleil and the base of Aristide that was there. In that space rose Emmanuel Dread Wilmer. Emmanuel Dread Wilmer started out as a homeless child who Aristide as a priest, because he was a priest, they were homeless children. He put them in a space, in an orphanage, or he put together a space for these children so that they can have something, you know, so they can, and so it was called La Famille, c'est la vie. But during the first coup d'etat, after Aristide was taken out, the terrorists, the military, they went to shoot those children. That's when Emmanuel Dread Wilmer learned how to protect himself and his community. So when Aristide came back, they called these people gangs. But they had to protect themselves because when Aristide was in exile, they were there. And they were the ones that the military came to kill. So they did whatever they could. They banded together. So during the second coup d'etat, when they took out Aristide, I have no idea, but Emmanuel Dread Wilmer and his group control Cité Soleil. Cité Soleil has something like, I think it's like 29 section. He control except one. And what you have to understand is a mercenary families in Haiti, there are 13. They're mostly Lebanese, Arab Jews, and Syrians. They control all of our ports, and they control our commerce, and they're the ones that are the subcontractors to the Gap. If there is a garment factory, they're the ones that's the middleman, because you're not going to sue the Gap or for not paying. You're going to sue these mercenaries, and that's why they wanted to destroy me, because I was trying to bring in the law to control things, and they didn't want the law. So essentially, in Cité Soleil, this area that was very politicized and that was very pro-Aristide, because they wanted jobs, they wanted dignity, they wanted to have an economic stake in their own country. Bigot and Merv, two of the families, they had because Cité Soleil is right on the edge of the water, right there, it's on the Gulf of Port-au-Prince. Essentially, They wanted to gentrify the country. The UN is their tool of gentrification. They wanted to get rid of those people because they wanted to. There's oil in that area. If you look at the, I have a map of Haiti's resources. The oil is right there. So it wasn't about Aristide being a dictator. It was because these people wanted to control the ports and they wanted to control the oil. And they needed to get rid of these people who were brought in to do garment factory. And then that's why you had the right next to the garment factory, there was the port where they would put it out, just like they're now doing in Caracol. But they were doing this in Port-au-Prince. So Emmanuel Dreadwell-Mayer took up arms and he said, if you're coming into my community to kill me, I have the right. And I, as a lawyer, I said, yes, you have the right to self-defense. If somebody comes into your community to kill you, you have the right to self-defense. What the Haitian oligarchs, these terrorists, these ISIS-like folks would do, they would hire other folks. They, one of them was called Labanier, to fight these gangs. So they would, okay. And so no one could get into Cité Soleil. All of a sudden, USAID is doing soccer games and Wycliffe Jean is doing a big concert. Soon after that concert, what they do, they have like drones. They follow the people, see where they are. They may not have known where they were. On July 6, 2005, the United Nations surrounded this sleeping community, 1,000 of them, and 440 UN troops. The best technology that they have went into Cité Soleil to find Dreadwell-Mayer. They killed, they massacred, they dropped bombs from the air on this civilian space and ended up killing Dreadwell-Mayer. And Dreadwell-Mayer had asked his community that thought of him as a hero, that if I die, don't let them take my body. Because back during our first occupation, when Haitians took up arms and tried to fight the U.S. Marines that had brought them back to slavery, there was a leader. His name was Charlemagne Peyrat. When the Marines killed Charlemagne Peyrat back in 19, I can't remember exactly, but we had the occupation for 19 years from 1915 to 1934. I think they killed him like sometime in the 20s, 20 something. They took his body, they put it on a nail and nailed it to a door so that everybody could see that this hero was killed, and they defiled his body.
Who's
that? Was
they?
U.S. Marines. Okay? You can find that picture online of Charlemagne Peyrat. In this second occupation, the Charlemagne Peyrat of today was Emmanuel Dreadwell-Mayer. So he said, don't let them take my body so that they would do what they did to Charlemagne Peyrat. So his community took his body, even though he was shot up. And then they gave him a traditional, traditional Vaudouist a funeral is when they take you out and put you out into the sea and burn the body. So that's what they did. And they did it after the UN left. But that day, July 6th, when this happened, I knew they were going to kill this man. I tried so hard to find people in the world to say, listen, this guy has never left his community. He's not a gang. They're going to kill him. They're going to execute him. As a lawyer, I said that if you have something, if you have evidence that this man has done bad, then you know, you can't execute him. You can't be judge, jury, and executioner.
Well, how many people did they kill in the process of killing him?
We don't have the figures. We don't know. But I have
estimate.
My estimate is like 60 people were killed that night. A lot of people died afterwards. One in particular was really, really sad. It was two little boys. I forgot their names, but they was in bed with their mother. One was like 1 year old, Sonia Romulus. 1 year old Sonia Remulus with his little 4 year old brother. The mother's in between. They're sleeping. The bullet went through one of the boys, through the mother, through the other one. It was a UN bullet.
So do they just, when they're looking to take him out, they just kind of take out a whole area and whoever is collateral damage is collateral damage.
That's right. And your audience can find this information online on something called the it's called the Cité Soleil Declassified Documents. Because at that time, I was like the voice of, you know, saying, you know, they've gone into here, they're dropping bombs, because I had members. Another guy that died, his name is Jean, Jean Ristil, he's gone too. Jean Ristil was taking pictures. If you see any of those pictures he went in there right at the time that the UN was doing this. So he took pictures. And there's a filmmaker, Kevin Pina, he has a movie, and that's Jean Ristil's footages. Jean Ristil is gone now, but he was so brave. So anyways, that's how they killed Emmanuel Dreadmoumere, and they killed about six. I know we said 60. We don't know how many people die altogether. And when he died, the people got together, and there's a Route 9 going through Cité Soleil. They said, hell with this. This is going to be from now on Route Dreadmoumere. Even if nobody cares and nobody ever acknowledges, we're going to call this, because here is our hero of the 21st century. So I can tell you that when I saw he was going to die, when I saw all the world powers were going after this, the world powers, one man, en Cité Soleil, I wanted to leave something of him. So we got an interview, and I was on that line when he did that interview. It was the most helpless feeling I have ever had in my life, because it was a couple of months before he was actually killed. He was killed in July 5th. I think it's May. There, you can find it on my website. It was done by Daoud André, one of our friends and collaborators. He did an interview, because I said, listen, they're going to kill this guy, and for the future, we need to have him. We need to have his voice. And so we have his voice on tape talking for himself. And I want to tell you something. You know how last time I was talking to you about the Red Cross and how heinous they are? Not only racist in different ways, but they're supposed to be this neutral space. And if you listen to that video, it's in Creole, but I have it in English. I have translated what he's saying in English. He says that the only people, like the UN was killing people. And they were like taking the bodies, trying to bring them to like wherever the Red Cross was in that area, Cité Soleil. And he says, you know, the Red Cross is there. I have since learned that part of the group of people that pinpointed his location were US doctors and other folks connected to the NGOs. Just to let you know that they're not neutral, even though they say they're neutral. So that's Dreadmoumere. I mean, you know, it is what it is.
Do you think a lot of those people could just be naive? I mean, they just don't. They think that they're.
We don't read. I mean, the information is out there. We the information about the Red Cross is out there.
Yeah, I know. I'm just throwing that out there. Well, your life has been in danger multiple times, 6 times. Yeah, and it's amazing you're still alive. Can you tell us about that and how you feel about that?
So many people have died next to me, that how I feel about that. Well, this is how I feel about it. I'm so happy that I'm here today with you. I live to get here, and every moment that I have, I cherish. And I know it could be my last. So I've lived to appreciate little things I would never appreciate. I appreciate you. I appreciate your audience. I read their comments. I lived to see that, because there was a time when no one knew who I was, and they could have killed me and nobody would have known. Now, at least, you know, somebody might ask what happened to Ezeli. So the very first time was the first time I went to Haiti. I was green as grass, very young. I thought that Bill Clinton, you know, really did want to change Haiti for the better, because that's what he said. And I went back with the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, and I had this judicial reform agenda that Haitians had got together and said that if we, you know, were able to bring Aristide back, we're going to try to reform the justice system so there's no longer just impunity that the rich could do whatever they do, and people can get killed, and it's just impunity. So we had that agenda. When I got to Haiti, the United Nations and there were 20,000 UN troops there, and I remember there was all of these tents of Brown and Root, which was Dick Cheney's space, right? So this is how they make money, right? So instead of the United States could have just sent a plane, just like they took Aristide by sending a plane for him, right? They could have sent a plane to get out Cedras, because who was the junta that they were taking out? But they brought in 20,000 or so troops, set up a whole village, and I saw them set up their whole stuff within just less than a week. Okay, I say this because during the earthquake, the United States somehow couldn't do anything for Haiti. It couldn't set up anything. I saw them set up a whole village where U.S. troops lived, where water, electricity, okay, because they have this thing of the CBs, right, where they can do the green zone in Iraq, and, you know, they can do this. So I always say to people that because of my experience, what I've seen, I know they let my people die in 2000 during the earthquake, because they could have sent the CBs in there to with big equipment to within the 72 hours that they say before people die, to lift up the concrete, save the people. They have, what do you call it, thermal things and satellites where they can see who's on the ground, right? They could have done all that. They done none of it. They brought in 30,000 combat troops and acted like we were cannibals or something, and when people were crushed. But anyways, back in that day when I, what happened to me was that I was living in a hotel called the El Rancho. I was pissing off a lot of the American military, American USAID, American embassy. They just hated me because I came to Haiti as the head, not only of the Haitian lawyers leadership, but there is a bar association, a national bar association that's made up of black lawyers. And at that time, I was the head of the Haiti task force for the National Black Lawyers Association, right? It's National Bar Association. And that was 17,000 black lawyers. Scared the hell out of them. It's like, whoa, who is this woman? How come we don't know about her? What does she want? And so they tried to get me. They told me I should not be representing Aristide. There was no money in it. Lavalas was ugly. Lavalas was a populist, communist, socialist, whatever words that they use to get you. They were saying it to me that I was a beautiful woman. I should be part of the Haitian oligarchy people. I told them I came back on behalf of the ancestors, on behalf of my parents, to do something, to use my skills to bring about the rule of law in Haiti. And I don't want your money. They offered me, USAID and those folks, $250,000 a year, tax-free housing. And if I had children, they would have put my children in the international school in Haiti. Okay? Of course, I was stupid like I am today. I told them, I was like, do I look hungry to y'all? But these are all the stuff that they have to buy you. And they did buy members of the Haitian lawyers leadership that went on the other side. And so anyways, one night, it was a military guy that came to me. I don't want to say his rank. He said, they're going to shoot. You need to leave because they're going to shoot you. And he actually told me when it was going to happen.
So he actually tipped you off and saved your life.
U.S. military that saved my life. Can you imagine? Effed up my mind too. Because that's what they do. It's the psych ops, right? On the one hand, one group is killing you. On the other one group is rescuing you.
Well, and that's because there are good people, right? I mean, they're in conflict.
I always thought it was good people. But now that I know too much about them, I think it was a psyop on my head. And the guy probably didn't even know. But they probably let him hear this thing. I call him Haitian Brother Man, DOJ. I say his name. His name is Carl Alexander. He is now the deputy head of the UN mission to Haiti, the minister mission, Okay, the head is a woman, a black woman, because they always use this identity politics for colonialism with these token blacks. So they used, her name is Sandra Honore of Trinidad and Tobago, and she is the head of the minister mission. She's a spokesperson for the Secretary General Guterres, and before that, Ban Ki-moon. But under her is the Haitian who supposedly wrote a letter. He was with the Haitian Lloyds leadership. I had met him in New York, and I had introduced Aristide to 10 Haitian lawyers who had been practicing for 10 years, who were admitted to American bars and who wanted to help Haiti if Aristide ever went back. He was one of them. I remember him calling my law office in Connecticut, just essentially begging me to connect him with Aristide. Little did I know that this guy was trying to get in so he could tell his boss that he knows Aristide and he could do X, Y, and Z for them. I didn't know this. At that time, I thought we were all in the same boat. We wanted to do something good for Haiti. So essentially, what I know about him is because another military guy came to me and said to me that Carl Alexander had drafted a letter for the signature of the U.S. ambassador. And in that letter, they said I had a conflict of interest and I had to leave Haiti because I had a conflict of interest. Their conflict of interest was that I was going to put, now get this, this is really ironic and it'll make you laugh. I was going to put U.S. aid to Haiti in jeopardy if I stayed in my position in Haiti. I was going to put U.S. aid to, okay? That letter is out here somewhere, and it was signed by Larry Swing, so y'all can find it. It's in 1995. But anyways.
It couldn't be any worse than it is today.
It can't be any worse, but that's the whole point. You see, I'm sitting here trying to bring reform that's Haiti reform, and yet the United States is doing all they can, not only to destroy me and this group of lawyers that just wanted to volunteer and give real charity, right? Not fake NGO charity. But real kind of, you know, let us participate in helping bring dignity and rule of law. They set me up. First of all, they set me up with this letter that they delivered to my hotel to say that, you know, I was going to. The way they set me up was they said that I was going to apply for the U.S. At that time, USAID had a judicial reform agenda of its own. And he felt I was competing with what they wanted to do. So they said the only thing I could do was bid on their contract. I said, why would I bid on your contract? I'm an expert at what Haiti needs because of all these. I was working at that time with the Haitian Supreme Court Justice. I said, these people are expert at what they need. I was working as the legal advisor of the his name is, I'll say his name because he's a good guy. His name is, Exumé. John Exumé was my boss, my legal advisor. He was the one, I was his legal advisor in addition to being Aristide's lawyer. I went to the Ministry of Justice and I worked there so I could see what we wanted to do. And in that space, that's what I noticed what the Europeans were doing. They would always bring in these technical experts that were spies, essentially, that would count who came to the office and what, and then try to go in and bring them into their fold. Well, when they tried to do it with me, it didn't work. So first they tried to set me up by sending me by putting me on the bidding list for this $160,000 they were going to give in 1995 to reform the judicial system of Haiti. They put my name there. I never wanted to do this. And they said that I was going to be a bidder. Once they finished doing that, even though I'm calling the Ministry of Justice and the mission director says, well, why the hell are you putting my name on this? I already have a job. Then they wrote a letter to the Minister of Justice and said to him that I was working for him and I had inside information, and yet I'm trying to be the bidder in this contract. And that they told John Exumé that if I stayed in my position, and my position at the time was a position I created. And this is really important because we're coming back to this thing about U.S. aid to Haiti. I created a position called Coordinateur des bailleurs de fonds. I was the coordinator of the donors who kept saying they wanted to give money for Haitians to reform their system, build back better. This was 95. The reason I did that was when I went to help represent the minister, and I'm sitting at his office, I see all of these different, you know, European Union people, Spain, Japan, Canada, coming in and saying, you know, we want to do this project. We want to do this project. And they're always having these meetings with the minister, and he can't ever go look at what Haitians want because he's having meetings with these foreigners. So I said, listen, what I'm going to do is I'll coordinate all this thing for you. And that's what I was going to do, coordinate how we can jive what they were interested in with what Haiti was interested in. That's the reason they tried to kill me in Haiti. And so that night when it was a colonel actually in the U.S. Army, I ended up spending that night in his hotel. I was at the Al Ron show. I had a bungalow. And he told me not to be in that room that night. And I was like, where am I going to go? So I stayed that night upstairs. I'll never remember. I'll remember it to the day I die. It was raining. I had my little, at that time, I love Sarah McLaughlin. I think her name was Sarah McLaughlin. I had to leave then, right? So I was playing I Will Remember You and my little song thing. That I would not forget this. And the next morning when I went downstairs, there were these big, I mean, fist size bullet holes on my, like, where I should have been asleep at. And so the guys from the because I didn't know then, okay, because I was pretty, I did not know that the El Rancho was a coup d'etat space at the time, and here I was representing the president, so I never knew I was in danger. That's what I'm saying to you, right? So God helps fools and orphans, I guess, whatever. Anyways, that's what happened. So, and I can still see in my mind those big bullets. That was my first time. I'll tell you very quickly my second time. All right. My second time was I was at the CEP, which is the Center for Electoral Council. Someone had just killed a Haitian lawyer that belonged on the other side of the coup d'etat folks. So, and I was there at that CEP, and I was representing, you know, the Democratic side. And it was two people, me and this other woman named Marie Lasseg. She's still here. And we were just like shaking like leaf because we couldn't get out of the CEP. And actually, this is kind of interesting. You know, nothing is very clear. Do you know it was the U.S. ambassador? Was it the U.S. ambassador? U.S. mission director. I remember his name too. Larry Crandall. He gave two black women who could have died that day a ride out of that space.
So you have started a water program, you know, knowing that $13 billion was given to the Clintons and there's a massive cholera problem. Thousands and thousands of people have died from cholera because they don't have clean water. And it would have only cost $2 billion to set that up in Haiti, and they just didn't do it, which is absolutely ridiculous. That in itself is a crime, I think. So you started a fresh water program, and you have been getting that going, and the Clintons specifically targeted you to shut you down. Can you tell us what happened there? And be specific, because I want people to understand how bad and how evil the Clintons can be and how they target people for their own nefarious activities.
Okay. When cholera hit, actually before the cholera hit, I found that the Red Cross was giving people dirty water. And it was, you know, so essentially I went looking, when I saw that they were not doing anything for the people, and cholera had happened. And I know cholera is the solution clean water is the solution to cholera. So I went looking for someone to help us. I couldn't think of one person that would believe me. So I went to see Minister Farrakhan, because the only person I think that would believe me, I didn't think anybody else would believe me. And it was very hard, because when I went in, Wycliffe Jean was coming out. But it all ended up well, because he basically said to me, I came very highly recommended by people that he really respected. I want to say some of their names, like Randall Robinson's wife and Susan Taylor, who used to do Essence. Like, these are very, very powerful folks. And so they said, you know, this person has been doing Haiti for 20 years. Listen to what she has to say. And he was gracious enough to do that. And to this day, I am eternally grateful to Minister Farrakhan. What he did was, he said, we're going to raise money. And he raised, I think it was $120,000 from all his synagogues or whatever you call those things. And at first, he was going to share it between me and Wycliffe Jean. But by the time that year was over, Wycliffe Jean was facing some sort of he was being sued. His company was accused of absconding. I think it was like $16 million. They said that he only used $2 million for the, like, if only I had that kind of money. Anyways, so by that time, other things were happening. And I think Minister Farrakhan trusted us then. We had created a relationship over the time. So he gave us that $120,000 that he had raised. I said, don't give it to me. I have seen in Haiti and other places where the U.S. military is there, a solar machine that can give clean water to 165,000 families per month. That's what I want. And he was gracious enough to do that. He purchased it. We brought it to Haiti. And that's how my clean water project started. And it's solar. It's a solar run machine.
So how many people do you how many people get clean water simply because of that 120,000?
Like I said, its capacity is 165 per month, and you can do 30,000 gallons of clean water per day on that one unit. It's called the Mac Pure O1 unit.
So how many people?
So we could do at least 165,000 people a month.
With $120,000.
Right? With $120,000.
Because you were focused and you were getting it done.
I was focused, and I said, this is what I, you know, and I wanted something that the women in Haiti and the men could operate themselves. I didn't want any intermediaries. So I asked Minister Farrakhan would he kindly also send an engineer, and we'll go and we'll teach the women how to use that machine. And he paid for that engineer to learn how to use that machine from the manufacturer, and then paid for the engineers to come down to Haiti. You guys can go look at Flickr, PhotoStream, Ezeli Danto PhotoStream. You could see the delegation when we actually inaugurated that project, okay? Now, this is how the Clinton comes in. So I have to say, though, we don't have resources to actually operate that machine the way I want to operate it. It's still giving clean water, but we are not meeting the capacity, because what I need is, like, right now, we need trucks so that we can do 30,000 and go to the places and bring it to them. And I'm still trying to raise money for that.
Okay.
So now, what we do is, like, on site. And so it's not that, you know, people come in on site, or we go to the Canaan, but we pay, like, I mean, I have a Zili Glow director in Haiti. We rent like a 3,000 gallon truck. We filter the water and then go bring it to the people in the tent spaces. Obviously, we want to be able to do more. But it's very hard to do that. Okay, so the next year, I had been looking before this whole earthquake happened. We had an army of NGOs in Haiti. There were 10,000 NGOs, and when the earthquake happened, there were 42,000 NGOs. And nobody has any public service in Haiti because U.S. privatized Haiti's public services, healthcare, all of that, right? That's what the NGOs are. They destroy you with coup d'etat and war, and then they bring in the charities. So they play both roles, as I say. They play firemen and arsonist. I mean, yeah, arsonist and firemen, hero, villain. They play both roles. So because I know that, that's why I said the thing about the colonel who asked me, because it was like it messed with my mind for years. I was like, wow, that was weird. Anyways, so I had found a project that would help Haitian women who were illiterate, who were market women. The market women in Haiti are the backbone of the Haiti economy. There's an informal economy, and they're the backbone. And that they're the ones that keep the family together. And so I wanted to be able to go to them and provide them with skills transfer. I found a program in India called Barefoot College Program. And this is where I suspect that the Clinton got involved. Nobody expected that I would get that program. I had to get the foreign minister of Haiti, which was Michel Martelly's foreign minister. You can understand how that might be impossible for me to do, right? But I did get the minister of justice, one of our folks, because we're very deep into Haiti. Even in hell, we have, like, you know, our own people. So we got a project to send four Haitian market women. The pictures are all on my, you know, you can find them. Zili Blo is the name of my project. And the project was so good that we did win the Energy Globe Award for that year. We send four illiterate market women who had never been out of Haiti ever. Some of them did not even have a birth certificate. So it was from grassroots, right? We did their birth certificate. We did their everything, clothes, everything. And I took care of their children while they were in the 6 months that they spent in India. So they went to India. And at that time, Barefoot College had never been to the Western Hemisphere. It had never been to Haiti, but it's been around for 40 years. Never came to Haiti for 40 years. Okay. So just look at the circumstantial evidence here. I brought this person, and he had this Megan somebody, I forgot her name. This white woman who was his kind of spokesperson. And this is what happened. This is always happens to Haitian. White folks come to Haiti. The first time they come, because they don't know anything, they think we're cannibals. They got the idea from the internet and from the media that Haiti is corrupt, violent, all this voodooist, you know, zombies and all kind of negativity. That's the metaphor for us, right? If it's bad, it's Haiti. But when they come and they see that's not true, and they get such a spiritual connection, they want to come back. But a lot of time they want to cut out the Haitian that brought them in. And that's what happened. So once Barefoot College was in Haiti, for some reason, they didn't think I was going to be able to do it. It was at a really bad time. It was at the time when we had another storm. Another big storm. Anyways, I had to even go to Cuba to get the passports done, all kinds of things, and so forth. So what happened was 4 days into the women being in India, Michelle Bachelet, who used to be the former president of, I believe it's Chile, was meeting with them. Now imagine women who, like, couple of weeks ago had never left Haiti, and now they're having an audience with a former president. I gotta figure out if she was in, I think it's Chile, former president of Chile. Michelle Bachelet is her name. Anyways, so I have a picture on the internet. You could see it. The women, you know, have like these Indian clothes they put on them and so forth, okay? Right after that, when they realized I had actually done it, they decided that a small organization like ours, could not possibly have enough resources to deal with this big deal. Now, I'm a lawyer. I had signed we hadn't even signed it yet, but our agreement was that I would have the exclusive ability to continue to do this. Like, I had this vision. There's like 300 villages in Haiti. I was going to give them clean water and solar power. They were going to, the technology program that India had would have provided the actual solar panels, and the women would run a solar center. And they learned in that 6 months how to put together this, you know, the batteries and the inverters and the solar center and the solar grid. And they were going to go and light up their village. And as long as you have electricity and you can light up your village, you can also boil your water and all of that. That was the project, because the one I did for the water was like in the urban area. This was like in abandoned rural areas. So every 6 months, the agreement with Barefoot College was that they would do two more villages, and there were two women for each village. And what was really, really interesting and really wonderful about that deal was that it was for women who were 35 and over, who had roots in the community, who were mothers, they were solar mothers, and who would not just, you know, take this experience and then, you know, go somewhere else with it, but would go back to their village and have a job. Because, you know, everybody in Haiti now has cell phones, and you need to they have to go down the hill to find the store or that space to charge their cell phone. But now they have solar energy and they could do that. And their children could have an education. All that stuff that I had an idea that so what happened was Michelle Bachelet meets with these people. The next day, I hear from this Megan person from Barefoot College, and they say, listen, we can't work with you anymore. Because you can't help us raise money for the solar equipment. When I had told them at the beginning, I'm going to provide you with these women, and they had agreed. They even gave me money to do some of the passports and all of that. So they basically said to me that they were going to look for that I didn't have the money to help them with their fundraising, and so now they were not going to go forward with the next group of people.
So did the whole project just get shut down then?
And I have four women in India, and I'm going crazy. So if you see, like, you know, I'm just an old woman now from all that bull. So I have four women in India. I have an entire village excited because they never believed it was going to happen, waiting for these women to come back to do solar energy for their whole space. And I told them my expertise is I could get this stuff out of the ports, because remember, it took me 3 months, but I was able to get that machine out of the ports. That's the thing, because the port is controlled by these oligarchs. They make you pay. They'll hold your stuff. I think I ended up having to pay almost $57,000 to get it out. That's after it got there, that first machine. I wasn't looking forward after all that hell of getting out solar panels, but I was willing to do it for these women. All of a sudden, they tell me that this exclusive agreement that I have, they're not going to honor it. And that was it.
And it was done.
It was done. So,
and nobody else did anything.
To this day, I don't know if they have ever had a second group, because I was told that certain oligarchs wanted to control the solar energy in Haiti.
Why do you think the Clintons were involved?
Because Barefoot College president, darn, for some reason I remember his name goes out of my head. Barefoot College president, like I said, he's been doing this for 40 years. All of a sudden, the next year, he gets the Clinton Global Initiative Citizenship Award. And I am told that that's $1 million plus the connections.
And then they never went and did it this the work in Haiti, but magically they got a million dollar award from the Clintons. I mean, that's how they work. That's, you see that pattern all over the place.